Chief Justices and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please. The first case on our calendar is 96-2311, State of Ohio versus Thomas Keenan, Mr. Mancino. I don't think you do, since the appellee is not going to be arguing today, so.
My name is Paul Mancino. I represent the appellant Thomas Keenan. In this death penalty case, the key or crucial issue, as I see it, is the first issue, concerning whether Mr. Keenan had the right to have his own privately retained attorney representing him on his retrial in this particular case.
The counsel clearly has the right to do that, but the question a little more than that, does he have the right to have somebody who's been involved with a co-defendant?
Well, I believe he does. I mean, in this case, there's absolutely no evidence of any supposed actual conflict that they claim existed in this case. The ruling in this case runs contrary to all prior cases decided by this court. And I think it's important to look at what the court said, the trial court said, at the time of this hearing back in September of 1993. All that the trial judge said is that possibly Mr. Mancino and or Mr. Deegan may be representing Mr. D'Ambrosio. Mr. D'Ambrosio's case was over. My only involvement in Mr. D'Ambrosio's case was to file his first appeal to the Court of Appeals. Thereafter, I had no further involvement, nothing further to do in the case. When the case was appealed to this court, new counsel was appointed by this court.
Wasn't that case still presently on appeal, though, when this trial came up?
Well, it was only on appeal to the extent it was a technical question which didn't require any argument, no really representation.
And if we had bought the argument that was presented and reversed it and remanded it to the trial court, then certainly we would have a new trial. So that would be ultimately wanting a new trial.
You mean in D'Ambrosio's case?
D'Ambrosio.
No, all that the remand in D'Ambrosio's case was that the Court of Appeals was required to identify whether certain documents that were referred to were in the record.
And what about post-conviction relief and all sorts of other attempts?
Well, I had no involvement in that at all.
And so you were involved in the original trial and gained all sorts of knowledge about D'Ambrosio and his case in D'Ambrosio's representation, did you not?
No, I was not involved in D'Ambrosio's trial.
You were involved in the appeal.
All I did was the appeal.
Presumably during the appeal, you read all the trial transcripts and you read and talked to the client and got information for your appeal, did you not?
Yes.
So if you're representing Keenan, and at least my reading of the facts, it's very difficult to figure out from your facts what the facts really were in this case, but my reading of the whole facts indicated D'Ambrosio did it. That's my gist of the whole fact. Is that what your argument basically is, that D'Ambrosio did it, not Keenan?
No, the argument is that Espinosa is the one who did it, not D'Ambrosio. D'Ambrosio's defense was he was not there, he was not present, that he was not involved in it, just like Keenan was. The evidence in this case, and the real evidence of any motive in this case, really was directed to Espinosa, who's the one who got the deal from the prosecution where he was allowed to plead to manslaughter on the condition that he testified that all the events leading up to it, the reason for any possible animosity toward Mr. Klan or anything, was the involvement of Espinosa and Klan, because prior to the event, on whichever day this allegedly happened, there was an argument. There was a very heated argument. Espinosa Espinoza had the decedent planned in the washroom. He had him up on the sink. He was hurting him. He had all the animosity. There was no...
But obviously somebody didn't buy that argument because Ambrosio was convicted.
I understand that. That's correct.
So you're telling me with all of that, those facts, with finger pointing to other parties being culpable, there's no conflict at all?
No, there's no conflict. I think the precedent from this court holds overwhelmingly that there is no conflict. The cases decided by this court are much more extreme, much more conducive to finding a conflict, and none was found. And we start first with the Mangross case, which I was involved in, and that involved one attorney representing two defendants at the same trial. And there was some possible inconsistent defenses that had to be asserted in that particular case. This court found that there was no conflict under those circumstances. That was followed by the Dillon case, where the one attorney was representing the defendant and also a person who was suspected possibly of being involved in the crime or related crimes. The same attorney worked out a good deal for the other defendant, and this court found there was no conflict. And I think most significantly is the latest case, the Gillard case, or Gillard case, decided by this court in June of this year, which was decided after we filed our briefs. And that, to me, presented a much more compelling or overwhelmingly a scenario where one could conclude that there was a actual conflict, where there were two suspects in the case. One attorney was representing Gillard. He also represented his brother, who was a possible suspect, and conceivably at trial, it might be best to say the brother did it rather than the defendant on trial.
And Ambrosio was a possible suspect and, in fact, was convicted.
He was convicted. His case was over. There was
the issue in that case, the two issues were ineffective assistance of counsel and plain error, so the standard review impacted that case to the counsel.
You talk, you mean in the
Gillard? Yeah.
Yes, but the court, in the opinion, went into some detail as to what is or what isn't an actual conflict in that particular case. And it seemed to me that while the case could have gone either way, this court ruled that there was no actual conflict, and that presented something that was ongoing. It wasn't a case that was over with. As involved in this particular case. What has to be remembered in this case is that the prosecutor really was going by nothing more than guess or speculation. This court says that you cannot go on a possible conflict, you must show an actual conflict. D'Ambrosio testified at his trial. His testimony was of record. If the prosecutor was going to use him, and I think you can see from the cross-examination by Mr. Gasper during the course of the trial, D'Ambrosio would actually have to commit perjury. He would have to basically change his trial testimony he gave at his trial under oath to conform with the theory presented by the state in this particular case. There was no real possibility that they were going to use D'Ambrosio. They even visited him. They visited him without an attorney being present. So there was no conflict in this case. And in this case, I don't think anybody disputes the fact that Mr. Keenan had the right to select his lawyer. That was denied to him. It was denied to him arbitrarily, I believe.
Would you, can you finish with that? So I wonder if you'd move on to your 22nd, the lesser included offense argument, prior calculation of time.
Yes, concerning that particular argument, as far as the prior calculation, looking at the state's view of the evidence, their evidence is that the deceased Mr. Klan was driven to the area of Doney Creek. There was some talk there initially, and then according to Espinoza, Klan was told, just put your head back on the hood of the truck, and someone came, they said Mr. Keenan came over and cut his throat at that particular time. It's more an impulsive thing. It didn't seem that there was any prior calculation and design involved in that, rather than the more of the spur of the moment type of event, which would, you know, authorize the either a lesser charge of murder under those circumstances, and or the involuntary manslaughter charge in this particular case.
Don't you have to couple with that action what was said by him seconds later?
Well, but that's after the fact, is that...
Well, what's after the fact?
Well, allegedly, according to Espinoza's version of the events, after the throat was cut, supposedly Mr. Klan jumped in the water, and Mr. Keenan supposedly told Mr. D'Ambrosio to finish him off, or some words to that effect. D'Ambrosio then supposedly jumped in the water and inflicted some life.
Should we ignore the words "finish him off"?
No, you shouldn't. It's more spur of the moment type of reaction.
What, finish him off is more spur of the moment than what?
Well, I think under these circumstances, it is to finish him off. It isn't something where you're going to plan.
Does show state of mind? Intent?
Well, intent, it does. I agree with that. That intent is only one aspect of it, where you have a purpose to, you know, cause the death of somebody, the purpose to kill somebody.
Well, don't you have to take this entire transaction into consideration? Keenan has him put his head down, he slits his throat, and then he tells the other man to finish him off. You're saying that's spur of the moment?
Well, I believe it is, because there's really nothing that preceded it, that there was a, you know, plan in the mind to kill him at that time. It was just something that...
They drove to this desolate area.
Correct. They drove there, but I mean, there's nothing in the evidence that I see that they drove there for the specific purpose of, killing him at that particular
location. What, in your opinion, was the reason to drive to this desolate area if it was not to commit this act?
Well, the whole reason in this case doesn't make any sense at all, because according to Espinoza, the only reason the Klan got involved was that he was picked up while walking, and Klan was not the target of anything. Klan was not being sought out on that particular night. It was through mere happenstance that Klan came to be with whoever he was with that night prior to him being killed. But when they spoke to Klan and went to Klan, they were looking for Lewis. They were looking for Lewis because supposedly where did Lewis live, shows where he lived, because he had taken something out of the truck earlier that particular evening. So the Klan was at no point in the case a real target of anybody's...
Well, he was a target to get information, and when he was unable to provide that information, this is what transpired.
That was the end result according to the state theory, but if you look at when things commenced, there was really no plan or anything to kill him or do any harm to him when he was initially supposedly picked up walking down the hill there.
Consul, help us understand the defense of your client. It was alibi, I wasn't there.
And basically, that was his defense. Of course, I mean, the other defense is that Espinoza was an unbelievable witness who, you know, had cut a deal with the state.
So it's, I wasn't there, but if I was there, I didn't plan it.
I don't think it went that far. I'd say that the first half of your question would be, the broker, I wasn't there, I had nothing to do with it. And many anybody did it, or anybody was responsible, was for Espinoza, or anybody else from Espinoza, and they had been with on that particular evening.
So, how does murder come in as a lesser included offense if your defense is, wasn't there?
Well, I don't think it precludes it, because you have to look at what is the state's evidence in the case. Does the state's evidence overwhelmingly show or prove prior calculation? Can reasonable people conclude it's not? I don't think it has to be based solely on what the defense presents as evidence. The defense can present their evidence through cross-examination, weakening the impact of the state case, and I think in those cases still be entitled to a lesser included offense, even if they put on no people, no witnesses, or no documents or anything in the defense.
Which was the stronger case against your client, the kidnapping or the prior calculation of design?
Well, I don't agree that any of them would be any of them.
Well, and which was the weaker? Which was the weaker? Let's put it that way.
Well, I think the kidnapping was weak because it was more viewed favorably to the state of an abduction in that sense, because it was really to take him
to find somebody.
To find someone else's house or apartment or where the other person could be located. It wasn't, you know, in the kidnapping or taking somebody out that, in effect, commenced to do harm to the person being the subject of the kidnapping. So I think it was more, in my judgment, more in line with an abduction rather than the kidnapping in this particular case.
Those might be terms of art. It's pretty clear that the claim that he was free to leave is pretty weak, isn't it?
Well, it is. I guess it depends how you view it. You can do it one way. I mean, he was there, supposedly, according to the state witnesses, they were parked there in the yard while others, supposedly a couple of them, went up to the apartment where Lewis supposedly lived. Not finding Lewis there, there's really no harm or anything being done at that particular time. There were a lot of people supposedly viewing this, putting him in the truck, or back of the truck, on that particular day, so, it may have not been 100% free to leave, but there was still some opportunity to leave, or leave it at a particular time involved in this particular case.
Is there any rule as to how much time must expire before there's prior calculation design can be proven?
No, there's no bright line rule that says, you know, it's 10 seconds.
So it could have happened here when he got into the water and your client said, finish him off. That there was a thought process that even though it might have happened within 5 minutes, 3 minutes, or 2 minutes, it was a plan to complete the act, was it not?
Well, I don't know about the plan. I would think that's more consistent with the intent.
Okay, strike plan. It was prior to the death, and it was calculated to finish the job, wasn't it?
Yes, but just...
That's prior calculation.
The whole thing unraveled so fast, according to Espinoza, that someone stroked and someone jumped in the water there, that whether they had the plan or not, I think is very weak under these particular facts.
Forget the plan. It was obviously prior. It's the calculation and the design to bring about his ultimate death.
Right, but when you look, I don't think it's been proven in this case, because if you look at what's the definition of more of a mental process that someone has prior to it, and obviously you never, you know, unless someone comes out and said I had prior calculation and design, you never generally are unable to prove it directly.
Or if someone comes out and says finish him off.
Well, I think that goes to the intent, that there was an intent to kill, not the,
The more he refused to tell them where Lewis was, the more they became disenchanted with him, wouldn't you say?
Well, they were obviously unhappy, according to Espinosa, but really nothing between the time that they went to Lewis's apartment or his house.
And didn't it seem from their activities that they wanted to impress upon him that they were serious, that he should tell, and if he didn't, there would be some grave consequences of his actions?
Well, the evidence on that, I think, came mostly from at least one of the witnesses was that, I think it was Russell, was that Espinosa was the one who was saying that, not Keenan.
Well, Ken didn't say, now, wait a minute, we're just kidding around. We don't really mean for you to tell us. They were all involved in this type of activity, were they not?
Well, to the extent they were all together, they all went from one location to another. They were together on that. But
well, they all wanted to know where Lewis was.
Well, They all
were becoming more and more infuriated, or more and more impatient with him while he was when he wasn't telling them where he was, weren't they?
I think we're putting all of them together, and they should be looked at separately in this particular case. According to Espinosa, the only one who wanted Lewis would be Mr. Keenan. D'Ambrosi really had no interest in him.
But they were all friends, weren't they?
To the extent they were friends,
right.
Other than that, he had no deep-seated personal interest, or he needed some specific information himself. Keenan, even according to the state's case, was saying very little in connection with the case. Show me where Lewis lives. And they went to where was thought that Lewis had his apartment, and that was it, very little. And I think we even look at what Espinosa stated from that point on, very little was said, that we're just going to take a ride, not that we're going to take a ride, you didn't show us or didn't deliver for us, so we're going to, you know, do some harm, or certainly some harm from that point on, so we didn't know if we'd be in Dome Creek area with this.
And cutting one's throat certainly is an indication of intent to end one's life, is it not?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I disagree with whether that constitutes, in this case, prior calculation and design.
But we shouldn't ignore all those things, should we, in arriving at prior calculation and design?
No, not at all.
And the jury is free to consider all those activities, are they not?
They're free to consider all of the facts and evidence in the case, but I think.
And are there not facts and evidence in this case that would justify prior calculation and design?
In my opinion, there are not.
There are not.
There are not those facts in this case, because I know.
So that the jury could, there's nothing there for the jury to consider then.
No, I don't believe that aspect or that element of that crime should have been directed out and the crime of murder was submitted to the jury under these circumstances, which would obviously eliminate the, well, it really wouldn't eliminate the death penalty because you have the supporting murder aspect of it, which does not have the prior calculation.
You feel the felony murder conviction was properly handed down by the jury?
No, I don't, but
well, you just indicated that there was no evidence of prior calculation and design, but there was evidence of felony murder. Didn't you indicate that?
Well, in viewing one side of the evidence, that's correct. You come to that conclusion. You know, view the state's case entirely that they presented in the case, you could come to that conclusion. And if you say that was the one involved in it, obviously.
So you want us just to throw out the prior calculation of the sign?
And also the fact that there was no kidnapping in this particular case. Kidnapping, there was nothing in there, nothing in the evidence, even from Espinoza, that they intended, when they left the apartment, that they intended to do harm or anything to Flanagan. Espinoza is supposedly the only eyewitness to what happened from the time they left the apartment until, and relates supposedly what happened thereafter. There was nothing here from Espinoza's statement that said, well, we're going to take him, in my mind, take him down there, kill him, because they stopped there and were just preceded by basically some casual talk, and then, you know, this unbelievable scenario that someone would be like a lamb, would just lay down and put your head back, not being forced, not being grabbed, not being threatened with a weapon, and just lay down and someone walks over and just cuts your neck. It's a totally unbelievable situation that an adult would do that in that circumstance and not even do anything, not even try to run, not even try to escape prior to anything happening to him. If someone told you, pulled out a knife and said, wait, just put your head back, I'm going to cut your throat.
So what do you do? Commit suicide?
No. The view.
I mean, he ended up with his throat slit and very much dead, so.
Correct.
So, what you're saying is that there probably was a struggle.
That someone, probably Espinoza is the one who's responsible for killing him. Espinoza probably snuck up on him and cut his throat, probably jumped him unexpectedly, not in the view he sold to the jury that claim to get out of this truck, go over there, talk, do some light, you know, chit-chat in advance, and then say, well, put your head down on the hood of the truck and just cut your throat. So it's more, say, more consistent with the fact that Espinoza did it and whoever he was with, not Keenan, but he's the one who was responsible, and obviously he got the best deal in the case.
Counsel, I'd like to switch you to another argument. Just the two related to the two charges are really a question of did they or didn't they have enough evidence to get there. Let's go to a constitutional argument that you raised. He asked to and received the right to participate in his own defense, did he not?
Yes, well, partially.
Yeah. But he was not permitted to engage in closing argument or in the argument. Is that correct?
That was the one. The other restriction is that he could not be present or participate in any sidebar conferences also.
In any case that you have that says he has the constitutional right to be present at all sidebar conferences?
Well, if one, generally the defendant is, I know he has the right to be present, but present when the court gives you the right to participate, the court should give you the right to fully participate. The problem we have in this case is we have all of these unreported sidebar conferences, and there's no way on earth to reconstruct what happened at those sidebars. Had the defendant been present at the sidebar, at least, and there was no court reporter present, at least he would have his memory as to what happened, but he's shut out of it. He cannot reconstruct it.
Did he or did he not waive participation in argument?
No, I don't believe he waived the court order that the court would allow him his motion to participate, but the court would not allow him, that was the court order, not allow him to.
When he asked, wasn't that part of the ask, that he was not asking to participate in argument, that he was only requesting to be able to ask questions and examine witnesses? Wasn't that the way he presented the request to the court?
That is not my memory. That may have been how it came out.
Okay. If that was the specific way that he made the request, then isn't there a waiver as to making argument?
Well, if he specifically stated that all I want to do is ask some questions, and then I guess he would be stuck with that. But that still doesn't go to the other aspect of being present and participating, at least so far as sidebar, where he filed a motion in advance of trial to record all sidebar conferences in the case. The court denied it, and then the court of appeals in this case said, well, Keenan did not renew it during the course of the trial. Well, obviously, he can if he's not present. He doesn't know what's going on in the case at the sidebar, whether they're talking about going to lunch or talking about something substantive in the case.
Just how bright is your client?
I can't be too bright to be involved in this case. To the extent, he's been through one trial in the case, you do gain some knowledge of being in court. In my experience with many people I've represented, those who've been in trial, obviously you've been through it, you have some knowledge as to what can happen. It's not law school knowledge in that sense.
Okay, well, in reading all of this, I guess I formed the impression that he's quite bright. Would that be a mistaken impression?
Well, I'd say he's more worldly wise than being bright, having gone through the things. He does gain some knowledge. He's obviously not a dunce or anything in that regard. He's not no intelligent or anything. He has gained knowledge by going through this case, having read it. The case is almost over nine years old at this particular time. He's been, in custody 9 years. There's not a lot of things to do over in Mansfield when you're, on death row there. You look at your case. Try to look at other people's cases, too, that are there. You do gain some knowledge just through that experience. Day-to-day application that you're learning there. What is there about my case? I would say he probably knows his trial and what came out of his trial better than I'll ever know it. If he's been through it, he's had that opportunity. I don't think he should be penalized for that. Now, there's nothing wrong with the defendant being interested in this case, nothing being, making suggestions throughout the trial. I always welcome that. I think it's a good thing that someone is showing some interest in their case, rather than just sitting there like a dunce during the trial, and everything happened.
Mr. Mancino, let me ask you a practice question. Page 74 of your brief, you make the statement, clearly the records show that the prosecutor intentionally misled the jury with outright lies by claiming them to be the testimony of evidence. Then you go on to say that even the court-appointed counsel didn't object. He was a party to this outrageous conduct. And then even the court chose to openly assist the prosecutor by condoning lies. Pretty strong language. My problem is that when we looked at the record, to see whether those statements had been made, even the judge's statement, we didn't find them. And I guess I'm wondering, what should we do about that? Anything? Well, I'm not going to go through them. I got a list of them. I'm not going to go through them. I think what you want to do is when you go leave here, you may want to read your brief again and look at the transcript and see whether the statements you've made, that's pretty strong language to say the prosecutor lied. I mean, we sometimes, in opinions, tell the prosecutor they've gone too far in closing argument or whatever, and we find it's not prejudicial error. I guess I'd just say to you that if you're going to make that kind of statement about the judge, and the court-appointed attorney and the prosecutor, you ought to be sure that the record supports it.
Well, I think it does in that regard, because the prosecutor told the jury one at time, the date didn't mean anything, although they started off the case and they're going to show a specific date, but this happened.
Well, you've given us quotes. These aren't paraphrases. Most of them I'm referring to are quotes. You quote the trial judge. The trial judge didn't make the statement that you say he made. So I don't want to argue with you about it here. I don't think we're wrong. If we're wrong, you know, file something. Tell me. But I think you'll find the record does not support a number of the quotes that you made, particularly with respect to the conduct of the prosecutor and the trial judges helping the prosecutor and the trial counsel. Your time is up, and you've used your time. Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.